You're listening to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction. On this episode, world building. Dave, Caroline, Jim, and Kelly talk about what it means to build a world and why we do it. Welcome to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction, a monthly, we'll get to that, podcast where we discuss the art and craft of writing in an attempt to bring a sense of community to the sometimes solitary life of the writer. I'm David Compo, and I'm joined by my fellow Deceptionist co-hosts, Kelly Stevenson.
Hello.
Caroline Pruitt.
Hello.
And Jim Rochkowski.
Hello.
And so I said we are a monthly, podcast because we were meant to be monthly, but we took April off because we all got together and actually met each other face to face for the first time. I mean, Kelly and Jim have met face to face. I don't know if I haven't met any of these folks face to face.
It was my first time
until C2E2, the Chicago. It stands for something about
Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo.
There you go. Nice. That's your two C's and your two E's. So we all got together in Chicago. We met face to face. We had a nice dinner with a whole bunch of our friends. And one of the things that we did while we were there was we attended a panel on world building presented by Arkea, the comics publisher. And we were all fascinated because as we talked about in previous episodes, we talked about how we wanted to we've talked about world building itself, but we actually told you guys that we were going to start a whole series on world building. And so this came up in Chicago, and we're like, we all have to go to this. So we sat in on it, and you guys can maybe help me refresh my memory. I know it was boy, I should have pulled this up because I'm not going to remember their names now. It was the.
I'm doing it right now. I'm trying to look them up before we get there.
I will, improvise right now. So we were at this panel, and there were three different writer artists, and they all had worlds built within their fictional stories. I'm losing my thoughts here. I know there was David Peterson of Mouse Guard.
Yes.
So if people aren't.
It was David Peterson. It was, Jeremy Bastian, who does Cursed Pirate Girl. And the last one was an awesome story about a dinosaur that lives in New York. And I am not finding it on Arkea's website not looking fast enough.
Was he also the artist from Redwall?
Yes, he was.
Which was a series created by a guy who passed away recently, but whoever the guy was who was on the panel had worked, and I was interested by how many visual artists there were in that, because it was sort of like the aspect of world building I hadn't really thought of was, you know, not just, you know, what are you talking about, what are you describing, but what do these things actually all look like. So I thought that was a good thing to have on that panel.
I think because we've been talking about it a lot as writers, as maybe pros, it was really interesting to go to a comics panel with a comics publisher, mm-hmm. because I think world building becomes much more apparent I guess it's everywhere, but I mean, when you think about it, choices made like the fact that it would be this medieval world of mice with swords and it really becomes instantaneous, that connection, like, okay, I get it, you know, this is a world, but you're dealing with mice, and, you know, what purpose does that serve for the writer artist? And a lot of it was the actual construction of the world in this panel, like the physical creation. David Peterson was fascinating to me because he actually built models of the ships that the mice would sail on, or the arches of the hallway, the medieval castle hallway that the mice would be inside, or the bar or tavern that they'd be in. He would actually build three-dimensional models out of cardboard and wood and paper and glue, and they were showing pictures of this along with it, and it was fascinating to me that, you know, we hadn't actually thought about physically world building, but this is what he was doing.
Which kind of drove me crazy. Yes. It was this, like, he was like, well, I didn't know what it was going to look like, so I just went over here and made this amazing sculpture that you could sell for a bazillion dollars.
Yeah, really.
Just to figure out what it would look like. Or he was like, he had the little sculptures. Like, the little, like, it wasn't just the, you know, the how he took a bunch of cardboard and turned it into amazing archways. It was like, well, I couldn't remember, you know, whether this guy had a peg leg on his right or his left, so I just, you know, made a little sculpture of him. Like you do. Right. It was just like,
right, exactly.
I feel like I write because I can't create any other way. Like, if I could make sculptures, if I could make little 3D adorable figurine, like, I would do that, but I can't do that.
Right.
So
right.
I write. Right. You know, I can hardly even construct a costume that looks the way I want it to look in my head. So I use my words.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's and that's something that I think we're probably all very envious of with these guys. We're all writer artists, and you know, it was fascinating. You're right. They had a beautiful 3D sculpture just so he could turn it to see what angle Peg Leg would be jumping down with his sword or whatever it was. Absolutely fascinating. So what did you guys think overall? Was the panel? I think we all got something out of the panel. Kelly, you were furiously taking notes, as I recall.
I was, and I have lost them, which is unfortunate. I remember the biggest thing for me was the gentleman who created Mouse Guard. I've already forgotten his name.
Peterson.
Peterson?
Yeah, David mm-hmm. Peterson.
David Peterson. So he starts talking about, you know, how important it is to get stuff down and to really think about it before you write it. And I'm sitting there and I'm like nodding my head and, you know, exclamation points on my notes. And it's just like, screw all of you who tell me to not plan stuff out before I start writing. He's, you know, the guy who does Mouse Guard agrees with me. And then right as I'm at like my most triumph. Full moment, he goes, but at the end of the day, you really just have to sit down and write it because it's really about the relationship of the characters and has nothing to do with the world. And it was like, no!
What I remember is glancing over at your notes and seeing in big letters at the top, how does he not know?
That's the other guy.
Oh, okay.
that's the, and I seriously can't find it on our KS site. I apologize for being so horribly prepared.
I don't think that
was the guy.
Yet.
It's not out yet, but it should be like somewhere. So it's the story of a Tyrannosaurus Rex who lives in New York City, right? And it's this like little kid, I think it's a girl, who sort of discovers him, and nobody else seems to notice that he's there except this little girl. And they're showing he's got like the visual that they have up is her sort of peering down the steps at her mom, who's sitting at the kitchen table doing something. And he's going on about, oh, I just threw this in because I don't really know. Like, there's an African mask on the wall, but it could be that she studied it, you know, for a while. She's probably been to Africa. I'm not really sure. You know, there's a picture on the mantle with the dad, but I don't even know where the dad is. Like, I don't know what his job is. He might not be there. And I went apeshit. It just... Oh, that's
I think the dad works in an office, probably. You know, like, because I thought he was like going to say like, well, the dad's a polar explorer and he was lost, you know, in the, right. 20 years ago, so we don't know. He's like, no, he probably works in an office. You know, I'll probably put him in a scene and he'll be wearing a tie. You know,
so. Yeah, it was just like, and it was. It started off as this interesting thing, like there's so much you can communicate within a single frame because the mask is there, because the picture's on the mantle, because, you know, the mother's sitting at the, you know, sitting at the kitchen table with a laptop. Like, you know, the scene communicated all of these things to the reader in a single visual element, which was really interesting and I think really important to world building. But then he's like, but I don't really know. I'll figure it out later. And I was just, oh, I was shaking. A friend of ours, Adrian, who's another guy from St. Louis, who's also a creator and a writer and is very much apparently exactly how I feel, because his wife was sitting between us, and it was just like between the two of us just sort of twitching. She could hardly stand it.
What if he just wants to discover it? You know?
Yeah, and that's something. It's funny because you're mentioning all this about that guy, and I'm so sorry we don't remember his name, but because he was very memorable, obviously. But it's funny because I remember that David Peterson saying stuff too, where he's like, "Oh, I didn't really know, you know, the whole backstory of such and such a city. I just needed a name, and that sounded good." And so I'm like, "Aha! You know, I see Kelly. He doesn't even know everything." But then later he's like, "Well, I have this whole naming convention that I use, so it all makes sense because I add this and this." And I'm like, "Oh my God. God, she's loving this."
Yes, I remember that at the end too. Yeah. I think it was actually Adrian.
Sean Rubin? Sean Rubin, R-U-B-I-N?
It could be. That sounds familiar.
And Bolivar is the dinosaur
book?
Yes. Okay, Bolivar, yes, that's who it is.
Definitely.
Well, we've righted that wrong at least.
Right, I know. Now on to the professional
opinions.
Back to the spreadsheets. Yes, so, it was. I think it was actually Adrian that asked him what sort of documentation he keeps, and he's like, "Oh, I don't really keep anything, but I just da da da." And then he's like, "I mean, I do have this one spreadsheet where I completely have broken down everything linguistically." And I was like, "You liar."
I think Kelly did a fist pump at that moment.
I may have, yeah. Well, because that's so fascinating to me. Like, of course, and it was just, I guess it justified not everything I believe about everything, but like, it's important.
Hearing him talk about his process drained the soul from my body.
Yeah, I think I'm more sort of over in Jim's camp, because I just keep thinking, like, if I had to do all that, I would never start.
Yeah. Right. That's the thing that it strikes me that we've talked about, is Kelly loves to plan all this stuff out, where I feel like I do come up with that stuff like Kelly does, but it's like it comes in the process of writing. So to Jim, to your point, it's discovering it. If I'm just writing it, like, just to do a profile on somebody, I think, I don't know, somehow I don't start on that. I get a little lost. I need to have a reason to come up with it.
And I definitely need to be better about documenting things, because yeah. I am the person who will ask people who have beta read for me, you know, what did I say about this?
Yeah.
right, possibly in something that I already wrote and finished. But sometimes just like, I know we were discussing this. I didn't put it in my notes. I bet you remember. So it's good to, it's right, good to have those right. people. For some people who work professionally, that's the fans. Like, you know, the fans keep the stuff on the internet, and then you go and look it up. You have to get to a certain level before you have those people, right?
Right.
Yes. That's why Rowling didn't shut down HP Lexicon until after she'd written the seventh book.
She knew somebody was doing a better job of keeping track of that than she was.
It's a resource.
I find it interesting that Kelly, you meticulously plan the world, but I feel like you're also one of those people who I've heard say the character does what it wants.
Ah.
Like, the character has no time for your plans. So, like, the world building is meticulous, but the character is like an eel.
Well, so the way that I think of it is the character is a wind-up toy. And and the world that I create is the process of winding them up. And then I let them go. And so I've got all these basic parameters. I basically create artificial intelligence inside my head. I have all these parameters. I have all these rules. I have this framework. And then I let it go. And then I write down what it does.
And that does make sense to me, that if you're going to work that way, you definitely want to have your world pretty well constructed. Because then you know if they go in one direction, you know what they're going to run into, basically. You know, whereas if you don't have that world constructed, you're not going to they're just going to, you know, go off in their own direction, and you don't know what you're going to find.
And if they run off into a void, I can't write anything down.
Yeah. Do you get to that point, though, where you have them open a door and you have to figure out what's behind that door? Or do they not open the door until you know what's behind it? Does that make sense?
I tried it that way once for my NaNoWriMo novel for, I guess it was 2000 and, let's see, if Elliot was born in 10, 2009. My whole idea was I wanted to basically create kind of I don't know, like a Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe sort of scenario where it's this girl, she lives in an urban environment, and she discovers, like, in the, you know, the secret garden of the cathedral that's on her block, is this sort of passageway to this amazing secret world. And, you know, it turns out that's where her father died, and, you know, the pastor's really her uncle, and just it's all sorts of stuff. And the only thing that I really wrote down before I started writing was getting her there. So I plotted out what her world looked like, what her real world looked like, how, you know, what her relationship is with her parents, why her father has left, how she's going to get there, what her relationship is with the church and that kind of stuff. And then it was like, and then once I get to the world, I will do just amazing things will just appear inside my head and I will write them down and everything will make complete sense. And I got there and there was nothing. And it was like, well, zany stuff should just be appearing, and nothing happened.
That's the feeling that I love, though, too. I love coming to that point where I'm like, now anything I want can happen, and a giant eagle drops out of the sky, and it talks, you know? I like that stuff, but there is a point where you have to make choices, because as soon as a talking eagle drops out of the sky, now you're doing something. And you can't go the other pathway. Do you think that's what blocks you? Because you're like, well, I don't know. Should it be a clown? Should it be a unicorn? Should it be, you know, or there's so many choices. And it's sort of like before you have to make a choice, you have that infinite canvas. As soon as you make one choice, you've now essentially built an add-on to your world. You're constructing a world. Now there's talking eagles and there could still be clowns, but, you know, you still have eagles and you got to deal with them now because they talk.
So
But if you drop a talking eagle, do all the birds talk? Is it just birds? Right. Is it all the animals? Do they all speak the same language? Do all the birds speak the same language? Do you know? It's like, do the eagles have dialects?
I think this is why you freeze up.
It's not why I freeze up, definitely why you need to make sure before you write that choice down that it's not going to have a ramification that you don't want to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, what if she goes along and then she's riding on the back of that eagle and then she runs into a stork and, you know, then you're like, okay, the stork's going to talk too. Well, now you've established the birds talk, or at least two of these talk. You know, I mean, is there something about you can keep going with the story while you're figuring this out? Or does that really bother you when I say this?
No, it bothers me. So I feel like there's an entire subgenre of all of this stuff. And it was, pulling up his name real quick, Jeremy Bastion with The Cursed Pirate Girl. He talks a lot, like, he very clearly created a world where anything could happen, where physics weren't a problem, where, right. you know, languages, whatever. He had whole, like, ships were bigger on the inside than the outside. There were people with, like, talking eyeballs. And it's like, once you've established that you're in that sort of theater of the absurd, then any clown, eagle can talk, whatever. But that's not interesting to me as a writer.
Okay.
So are we moving toward the why build worlds question, or are we still on
background? I think we are, but I think we were just kind of letting the conversation flow. Uh-huh. But I think we should step back, because I think what we're talking about is also the definition of, you know, what we're talking about world building. But in doing so, I think we're kind of shedding light on what we mean by world building as a way of moving into that why question, which we're going to tackle next. So I just really quickly, maybe we can just go around and just say, you know, what we mean by world building, because I want to add to it that on one level, I think that any time you write a story, even a memoir, you're kind of world building in the largest sense, which is you're transcribing something onto paper. It maybe happened, it maybe didn't happen, but now someone's going to read it. And the idea, I can't remember who said this. I remember learning it in a creative writing class in college, but it was the idea of, you know, a story being a continuous fictional dream, and the idea is to not interrupt that. And so in my mind, that's a little bit of like world building, because you're sort of, even if it's the real world, if it's our world, you're having characters make choices that impact other characters, and you have to keep that continuous. You know, if a gun is fired here, you know, like Kelly, like you were saying, it's like the physics have to make sense in some way, you know, or another. Like you have a continuity that you establish as soon as two characters meet in a story. You know, there's a continuity, there's history, that you're growing that world as you go. I think for the purposes of this show, though, we're going to talk more about, you know, worlds outside of our own, because that's something very common in stories, in fiction, and always has been something outside of our of what we know and why we do that, which is what we're going to get to next. But I'm curious about what you guys think about when you think about the definition of building a world in a story.
I mean, to me, it's really an obstacle you have to overcome, at least initially. Like it's not necessarily a thing that I get excited about the way I think some people do, because it almost seems like in order to do the kind of story that I'm interested in, I want to have these tools and I want to have this kind of something where I don't feel like I'm just like, you know, ripping off something that somebody else has done. So I want there to be something that's unique to the sort of milieu of the story that I'm telling, but it's not in itself what's of interest to me. Like I don't particularly like whether the mechanism is superheroes or space pirates or vampires or whatever that's not necessarily what it is that I latch onto. So that's why I sort of see just sort of figuring a way into it as a challenge. So kind of the idiom that you're going to be telling your story in is not to me the story itself. So it's kind of this sort of dress, almost the sort of dress and costuming of the world that you're telling the story.
It's what Kelly talked about. She said the wind up toy. It's the winding up, but it's also the stage that you set that wind up toy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
It's the vehicle, not the destination.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that there are great, I mean, there's things that I'll find in that someone else has done in world building. And I say, oh, that's wonderful. I love that idea and the possibilities that gives you. But I don't tend to sort of have those ideas myself. So that's one of the reasons that I'm really kind of interested in talking about how people do that and how people get those ideas to work, because it's still a little mysterious to me.
We've debated before the practicality of magic needing rules. Yes. I think this is a pet topic of Kelly's, and I think the point that she's made in the past has been that, you know, I always said that the whole point of using magic was being able to disobey the physical rules of the mm-hmm. universe, and she countered with that, you know, if you didn't have rules, then it comes, you almost can't help but come across as forced and not genuine or ludicrous or whatever, you know. You have to know what the boundaries are of even this insane, unreal thing, because people can smell a fake, I guess.
And mm-hmm. I agree with that, but I think my inclination is to have like one or two rules or one or two things that are specific to this world that are really interesting and really awesome and fairly simple. And, you know, and then sort of build outward from them. Whereas I think for some people you want to have a more complex system starting out. Whereas I would be okay, this is where the vampires, for instance, come from, and this is how you kill them. And go from there, you know.
And making sure that those rules are conveyed.
Yes.
Like, one of the problems I have with a lot of the trendier vampire fiction in the last couple of years is that they're using a completely different set of rules than the ones that we have understood since Bram Stoker, but they're not communicating what they are or why they are that way, or, you know, what sparkling has to do with anything.
I have so many thoughts. I have so many thoughts. So just as far as, yeah, that's a problem. Right. And like, if you have a few rules, make them simple and convey them and stick to them. Like, find a way to communicate those rules early on and then stick with them.
Well, I think we definitely in a future podcast will need to definitely talk about how, once you've figured out what your built world is, how you convey that to the reader.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
That's a completely, like, not obviously not separate topic, but mm-hmm. that is its own, that is a, mm-hmm. that is the next problem, I think.
Yeah.
Once you build your world, how do you tell people what it looks like?
Exactly. Okay, so Kelly, did you want to chime in with a definition of world building to you, or did we kind of already cover it?
Well, I don't know. I guess what I think we've covered it, but I think what I'd like to say is, you know, we talk about stories that don't need world building, and I don't think it's that they don't need world building or they don't have it. It's that you as the author don't have to do as much work to build mm-hmm. that world for yourself. Like if you
right.
if you know you're setting it, if you're setting, you know, you want it to be modern, you want it to be this world, for example, you've mm-hmm. just built the world. You've said it's this world.
Yeah.
You want it to be, you know, I think, Caroline, you wrote a story about a woman who's like running late to a concert or something and she's listening to the radio. Like you've built your world. She's going to a concert. She's you know, got her own car. She's going somewhere. You know, it's. I mean, that's that world is built. It just doesn't take as much time as a world that the reader probably isn't going to be familiar with.
Right. Yeah. And it was like it was important to me when I was working on the story to figure out how long it would take her to drive from Chapel Hill to Richmond, and to make sure that that was right in the story. And then, you know, five people who are listening to it who have made that drive would want me to get that right, but the majority of people are not really going to be, you know, so that's not that important to the story.
And when did you figure that out?
How long it takes to get to Chapel Hill from Chapel Hill to Richmond?
Like, sorry, when in your creation process, when did you figure that out?
Oh, I just... You know, I was like, okay, I need to figure out what I'm going to say she leaves and when she's going to get there. And, you know, yeah, it doesn't take very long.
Right. The closer you are to the real world, the more your built world is sort of inherited, right?
Well, I'll tell you what. Basically, I needed her to be running late. So because of that, I actually had to build a thing in there. Ah. I'm like, okay, because if she just left after a normal work day, it would not be hard to get here. So I had to actually put in things because I was figuring out the distance from where she was supposedly going in the real world. You know, so that was – and so I couldn't actually just –
So your roadmap of your world was shaped by what you needed the character to be overcoming or going through.
Right,
which
exactly.
Is really interesting.
Like,
I mean,
No, wait. Oh, it sounds like you actually said the opposite. So you – and this may sound nitpicky, but I think this is kind of a core element of world building.
Okay.
Did you start with the two cities and be like, well, crap, that's going to be 25 minutes, so let's have her late? Or I need her to get to Charleston. I need her to be late, so I need to find a city that's X distance away. What is that city?
Well, no, I knew – I had reasons, and I can't even remember what the reasons originally were for what the two – well, okay. You know what? The reason I had her going to Richmond is because that's where I live, and I would be able to describe a place for her to go.
Right
and
on.
Then I already had in mind where the city that she would be based was. So then I figured out how long it would take, and then but I needed her for the story to get there late, because the point of the way that story is constructed is that she walks in when the show's almost over. So I had to actually put into the story things that were happening to her to make her be late for the thing.
Oh, I see. Okay
so that's what I was saying. Whereas if I had said that she was in Atlanta, it would make sense that she was late getting to Richmond because that's a 10-hour drive.
Right. So you had the established roadmap, which is reality,
right,
and
right, exactly.
Where you wanted the characters to be, and then you had to add other things into the story to make the geography, the timing makes sense, mm-hmm. I guess.
Right.
Because you had the geography locked in. Okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I thought you had changed city because of that. No,
yeah,
I just didn't understand.
Which is a completely which is another sort of thing you do when you world build, though. It's just one of those things where sometimes the world drives the characters in this case, and other times, especially when it's a fantasy world or a made up geography, you can make you can make the world shape to what you want it to do.
Right. I could have made, if I was inventing the cities, I could have put whatever distance I wanted between them.
Or looked at a map and found a different city for her
right.
to originate
right.
from because right. you needed the right one.
Right.
Right. And that's something that I think kind of came up in that Archaea panel as well, which is, you know, when does the, I think one of them said, you know, always make sure that the world serves a story, or because I was curious about I didn't get a chance to ask this, but I was kind of thinking in the back of my head is, you know, when does the world build serve the story, or does the story fit into the world, and it's probably a mix of both in many cases, I would say. I know I can say for my own personal example, like, so my biggest built world was Wyrmwood, and in that I mean, I knew that I wanted to have supernatural things. And so I think I started with a base template that anything supernatural that you've heard folklore about, from vampires to occult rituals, they pretty much all work. They're pretty much true. But then there'd be deep. So I just go in assuming that, okay, you know, vampires can be staked and sunlight kills them and stuff like that. I'm like, I'm fine with that. But then as I needed like a ritual to go a certain way, I would sort of push things as I needed them to push. So I would actually do a lot of research of like old grimoires and stuff. So because I wanted the occult rituals to feel kind of real. And I always felt like I want to make sure that there was a lot of ritual and sacrifice involved in doing magic in this world. But because I didn't want it to be easy, you know, it goes back to what you guys were saying about when there's no rules, it makes it too easy to do a convenient thing. I always wanted to make magic difficult, because any story that involves something supernatural, whether it's, let's say, King Midas touching things and turning to gold, or, you know, Icarus and his wings, you know, there's always sacrifice. There's always a problem. Nothing, when we try to do things easy, it doesn't work out right. So I kind of look at magic the same way. But I would need certain things to happen to fit the story. And so I would sometimes push the magic, like, well, this is kind of realistic based on the folklore or based on the history or this old book or something like that. But now I'm going to just twist it a little bit so we can fit it into this murder mystery that we have going on. So, you know, I definitely, especially with magic stuff, I think that's really easy to do, because, you know, it's not like a police procedural where I'm like, you know, I'm going to have the captain.
Right. Wave habeas corpus.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I think that's what makes your world better than the world of, say, some recent vampire novel writers. You recognize that there's balances. You recognize that it's boring when it's easy. And so if you – there's a difference, I feel, between tweaking existing mythology and taking what we all know and twisting it a little bit and tweaking it to work with our stories, and taking a word – and like, say, vampire, and removing everything about mythology that's inconvenient without adding something else back in. So if you take away the fact that they have to drink human blood, if you take away the fact that they explode when the sun hits them, if you take away the fact that, you know, they're mindless creatures, if you take away all of that, you're really not left with anything interesting. There's no challenge. There's no penalty to being a vampire at this point. You just hang out in the shade and eat rabbits. Like, it's – and live forever. And then you get all the perks, right? You get to live forever. You get super strength. You get super hearing. Mm-hmm. You get, you know, to fall madly and passionately in love with your soulmate forever. Like, there's absolutely no consequences. And that's – to me, that's boring more than anything else personally well, offensive to it, because I like vampires.
Isn't it that – excuse me. Isn't it then the – job of the writer, if they're a good writer, if they're making sense of it. Let's say you do all that. Well, I think you could still tell a story that has consequences. It's going to be a different story. It's not about having to drink blood. It's about being immortal, and maybe there's some issues that come with that, or, you know, or maybe it's hard to love someone when they grow old and die and you don't, or something like that. But you have to find the you know, the drama in that situation. If you just make them superhuman and there are no consequences, well, you have a boring story. You know,
well, so I think why use vampire at that point? Why
well, I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, it doesn't sound to me like those are vampires. I'm just saying, like, call it immortal, call it superhuman, call it Superman, whatever you want to call it. But you can still make a good story out of it. You've just established that these are your rules. But yeah, what you're doing is, I think I almost feel like that's stepping into something else, which is changing popular culture or mythology, or, you know, changing mythology or folklore to match what you want to tell, which is, you know, I don't know. That's kind of it borders on our world building discussion, but I also feel like it's something else. It's, you know, why even call it vampires, like you said. That said, if you just said it was an immortal and you told a story, you could still tell a great story and you would have no problem with that, right? Because
I would have much less problem with the fact all that you're of those inventing hypothetical books.
Yeah. The fact that you're vampires. Inventing the rules is fine if you are inventing the demigod as well, or whatever else it is.
Yeah.
For some reason, and I don't know if I can articulate why, but for the last 10 minutes I've been fixated on the TV show Dallas.
Oh, please tell us.
Because it's coming back?
Well, it is, but I've never heard anyone sigh into a microphone that loud.
That was awesome.
Bobby Ewing. was a character on that show. And the actor wanted out, and he got killed off. And he was off the show for a season, at the conclusion of which he turned up in his wife's shower. And when they came back from the summer break, he announced that the entire previous season had not happened. It had been a dream that his wife had. His wife had a year-long dream about everyone in their town, and magically none of that had taken place, and now Bobby Ewing got to be back on the show. I don't know if it qualifies as world building, but that just seems like Dallas had a set of rules and an environment and a set of things that were possible and weren't possible. And at that point, it took all of those things over to the balcony and dropped them over the side.
I think that's just a stunt. Like, it was... The season leading up to that was more or less normal up until the last two or three episodes where all sorts of crazy shit started happening. Like, everyone died and everyone got attacked, just all sorts of random things. And then after Bobby came back, it was normal again. Like, there was no, like, oh, surprise, the last five episodes were JR's dream, or surprise, yeah. Sue Ellen went on an alcoholic bender. And yes, I watched the show. and, you know, so it was just kind of like a stunt to fix something, a cheap stunt, if you will. I think that's different than world building.
You're probably right. I'm just thinking in terms of you know, setting up the way things are and the way things aren't, and then just jettisoning it at all when it becomes inconvenient. Although I think the series finale of Dallas actually literally had Satan in it, so maybe
getting confused with Days of Our Lives.
Oh. No, there was something. I'm sorry, JR was looking in a mirror and he was talking to the devil. Anyway.
Yeah, well, he kind of goes to crazy town. Well, and then, what was it? The Newhart show?
That was great.
Ah, yes.
Like,
okay.
You know what, 7 years later, did a riff off of that where he woke up after, like, running the inn for however many seasons, woke up, like, with his wife from a previous show.
Right, yeah.
Not to completely leave world building and talk about old TV shows, but that was fun too.
But I think, I think we've kind of tackled what we mean by, I think if people are listening to this, by now they've got a sense of what we're talking about in world building. We're talking about, you know, the rules, the map that you employ, the stage upon which you set your characters, and so I want to kind of, for this being our first show about this, and we're going to do a number of shows, and we're going to talk in detail about everything from clothing to, you know, science and magic in the world. But I think to start off this series, we wanted to talk about the definition, and we wanted to talk about why you build worlds. Like, why is this even a question for us as writers? And that's something that had been on my mind for a long time, because as we've been talking about this, I've become really fascinated by it. And I've talked on this show and others before about, you know, sort of how I loved fantasy as a kid and kind of went away from it and have kind of come back to it and really examining again what it is about fantasy that fascinated me as a kid. And then really starting to think about world building and what that means. And, you know, even given the fact that I had done shows where I had built worlds, or, you know, stories where I built worlds, I had never really thought about it in those terms. And then, but I guess what helped it coalesce for me is of all things, an art exhibit. So I had all this in my mind, and then a couple months ago, at the a museum here in LA, they were running an exhibit on surrealists. It was women artists, surrealists in California and Mexico. And so this exhibit, it's called In Wonderland. It's at LACMA. If anybody's in LA, they should definitely check it out while it's still there. And so it had artists like Frida Kahlo and a bunch of other artists that I had never heard of. And, you know, we went through and we were listening to one of the tours, and I really was stunned I've got all this in the back of my mind about fantasy worlds and Tolkien and, you know, worlds of magic, worlds of science, and all these things that we build that are not reality. And I'm looking at these pictures, and there are so many worlds built into these pictures. It's, you know, I think when people think of surrealists, one of the first names that probably pops to your mind is something like, you know, Salvador Dali, right? And so you think of melted clocks and stuff like that. But when you go through this exhibit, it reminded me, wow, there's so much you can do that's considered surrealism. And a lot of them were landscapes. There were simple landscapes, and they were very evocative. there's one I remember that it's something like you see this desert in the distance and two like shapes, and there may be people or there's stones and they're casting shadows, but you're seeing it all from like a cliff face where you're kind of in a ravine and you're completely in the shadow. And the title of the work was something like, you know, I cast no shadow. And when you look at the title and you look at the portrait itself, you know, there's such an emotion behind it because you're feeling like you're this person in the shadow, so you don't cast a shadow like those way out there in the distance, those people out there who are casting long shadows across the landscape. And this person just created a completely fantastical landscape, but they did it to get at this emotional feeling. And so I started thinking about, like, you know, why paint a strange landscape? Why not just, you know, there's a lot you can do, just like, say, a photojournalist. What's the difference between a photojournalist who captures pictures of war, or capturing something about the human condition, but they're capturing the reality? And take that on one hand, and then take on the other hand a surrealist landscape. Or there were a lot of paintings that I was looking at that were these sort of creationist drawings. It's hard to explain, but there'd be like this person with a moon for a face, and they're painting a bird that's, you know, the stars are coming into their pen and painting the bird, and then the bird's flying off the page. And so it's this whole fantastic world, and it's about creation, it's about the act of creation, and it's something that you get to that you could not photograph in nature, but it pulls you in and it has this real emotional impact. So I guess all this started swirling around. I started to see, oh, I get it. You know, when you think about art, it makes perfect sense. You create something that's not a literal depiction of something in the real world because you're filtering it through your own psyche and you're getting it to say something. You're trying to get someone to feel what you feel. And so I guess my question to you guys is, why is that? Why we do it in fiction too? I mean, I want to talk about why set up a world with vampires in it? You know, is it something where you're trying to get at some emotional thing, or is it just playing with those toys because you like them? It excites you. Is it a mix of both? Are you more successful when you do it one way or the other? I don't know. I just have a lot of questions, so I wanted to open it up to you guys and ask you guys what you think about it.
Well, you've certainly put a lot on the plate.
I'm sorry.
I was on mute.
I've been saving that up forever.
Clearly, that was awesome. I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I will let other people... I will not monopolize the thoughts. Or I will.
I know what I want to say, but I'm not sure that I am articulate enough to put it together yet.
I think the answer is yes.
Or no.
I know,
end
or
no. Show.
Possibly both. Or banana. I sometimes when I create a world, it's because I want to explore a problem that you can't explore in the real world. Sometimes it's because I'm tired of other people creating crappy worlds and I want to do it better. I know that, like,
amount of my writing could be summarized as no.
Right. I think that's completely legitimate. Like, I mean, that's the reason why I write stories anyway. It's because I'm reading stories and they're not doing it for me. And so it's like, well, fine. If nobody else can write a story that's going to hit these points, I'm going to write it myself. Damn it. But I think, I mean, I know that the one major vampire world that I created, it was because nobody else seemed to be writing a story about what happens at the moment vampires come out. Like, even True Blood takes place like a year later. So I wanted to start there. And so I had, because that was a problem that I wanted to solve, I had to create the world to get there. And then the characters came later.
So wait, before you go on with that, I'm very curious about that. Because now you felt like there's a story there that wasn't being told. And I'm curious, what was it, just something that excited your imagination? Or was there like some kind of emotional connection there? Like, you know, there's something scary about that, or there's something exotic about that, and I want to explore that because it excites me somehow. Like, it interests me. There's territory to mine there that, you know, like, maybe, I guess what I'm getting at is there an emotional connection to that story?
Well, we could devote an entire show to vampires, and then Kelly won't ever mention them again. Also, for the record, I never bring up vampires first. I always let someone else do it.
You've been very good about that.
I
I think there's a lot of really interesting things about humanity that using vampires, and this is true probably a lot of supernatural creatures, whether it's superheroes or spacemen or vampires or werewolves or fairies or whatever. I think there's a lot of things about the human condition that those types of characters allow you to play with better. They kind of bring, like, vampires are completely controlled by hunger and lust. And so you create this character, and then you can explore your own sort of curiosity about hunger and lust and, mm-hmm. and do it in a much more heightened way. They're also immortal creatures, so they can know things. They can live for hundreds of years and look back with a perspective that we don't have. I mean, it's that whole, it's sort of, it's a backwards fountain of youth, right? It's like, what happens to a person who actually has lived for 200, for 300, for 2,000 years? Like, what do they see? What do they perceive? And for me, that's fascinating. If I had all the time in the world, what would I do with it? If I had unlimited ability to learn things, where would I start? Where would I stop? I'll get off the vampire pedestal, but that's why I love vampires.
But no, yeah, but I mean, you can. But vampire is such a malleable metaphor. I've seen it used to, you know, where vampirism is really about addiction. I remember a play during the height of the AIDS crisis that used vampirism as a metaphor for HIV. You know, I've seen it. It's represented fears. It's represented immoral, you know, impure thoughts, as they used to say in the confessional. Which is why it so pains me to see someone take a metaphor as malleable as vampirism and turn it into sparkly fun times. But everything you say, everything you do when you build a world is really you talking about the way you see our world. Like,
right.
Those – what's their names? The Wachowski brothers had something to say about life when they created The Matrix. You know, they had something they wanted to say about the way we live now that they used The Matrix to illustrate. People talk all the time about Gene Roddenberry and the original Star Trek.
Right.
You know, he was using alien worlds to talk about our racism or our sexuality or our, you know, ethics, it might be.
Jim, what do you – I like that you said metaphor. So what do you think drives writers to pursue a metaphor rather than pursue – the actual story? Like, so, you know, we talk about racism or whatever, you know, is it because is it a little safer for people? Is it just you can explore things in a way you can't? Like, I get what Kelly was saying about vampires being immortal because none of us are immortal. So it's really us imagining, it's really us putting a focus on humanity and saying, like, if you could do this, what would that mean for humanity? But when you talk about something like a Star Trek episode and it's all about, very clearly, it's, you know, this allegory for racism, you know, why not just tell a story about actual racism? What do you think is the, what drives the writer to create that metaphor?
It's a spoonful of sugar helping the medicine go down, I guess you could say. Like,
okay.
Like Fox News got mad at the Muppets because an oil tycoon was the bad guy in the movie. And I'm not even making that up. So, like, the people have their backup about so much stuff, especially lately, that if you can do a little puppet show to get them thinking about the idea without feeling like they're being put on trial, or, you know, if Gene Roddenberry could very easily have gone on NBC in 1967 and been like, "You're all a bunch of racists," but
right.
He probably wouldn't have lasted very long. But if you put Gorshin in the half white, half black makeup and the other guy in the half black, half white makeup, everybody, you know, has a rollicking good time on the cardboard starship set, and nobody feels judged, and people are thinking about things they would be too defensive about to think about otherwise, and Keanu Reeves knows Kung Fu, and there you go. So, yeah, I mean,
can we talk about how much you love The Matrix?
The Matrix is the worst series of movies ever made.
I wasn't sure which direction you were coming at that front.
I sense a love.
That's another.
It's one
podcast,
of my favorite Jim rants.
We'll do like a Kelly, you and I will do like a dueling banjos where you talk about vampires for a minute and then I go and Neo can't get hit by bullets and then the climax is a gunfight. What the hell is? And we'll just go back and forth.
I definitely think we should revisit that theme when we talk about like perpetuating your rules through the story and making sure that you're consistent.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. This is very clearly another topic for a show that we're going to have to examine right. in depth. Yeah,
let me try to come at this from a little bit of a different angle because I think you guys have covered the metaphor idea really nicely. I think. I don't necessarily, and like, I guess the reading that I've been doing I don't necessarily think of it in terms of wanting to set up a metaphor or an allegory that's necessarily sort of standing for something else so much as just kind of like sort of tugging on an idea and seeing what you can do with it. So I think, like I was talking about earlier on, and like maybe one of the reasons I have trouble with it is that when I tend to come into world building, I tend to think, okay, I just want to make the toys so that I can play with them. You know, I just want, and I, you know, whatever it is, I just want it so then I can go have my, you know, space opera or whatever. But and I'll give an example because there's a book I'm currently reading right now. And this is going a little bit more into the sort of the urban fantasy side rather than the other world fantasy. I always get in trouble for not using these words correctly, but I'm using urban fantasy in the sense of basically starting off in a basically current our world setting and then injecting a fantastic element into it. So I'm currently reading a book that's called Zoo City. Has anybody heard of that?
No.
It's by Lauren, and I'm going to say her name wrong, but I think it's Lauren Bukes. She's a South African writer, and it basically is it kind of feels like she sort of started out with an idea from the Philip Pullman series, his Dark Materials, which basically is the idea in that book is basically sets in a world where everybody is bonded to this like animal companion, and she kind of takes some of the physics of that, but basically it's only certain people who have these animal companions. And they basically are cursed with them because they've committed a terrible crime. So basically, you can go out in the world and see everybody and know who are the terrible criminals because they have this animal that's kind of attached to them, which is a really bizarre idea. But the story's grounded, you know, basically in modern Johannesburg. And so I think part of what makes it appealing is, you know, as an American reader, I don't know that much about this. This place that she's writing about, and she's obviously writing with a lot of knowledge that seems to be fairly based on what the city is really like, and then just is injecting this sort of extra element, and then sort of seems to be saying with this, and I mean, there is that metaphor and that allegory sort of aspect to it, which is sort of you kind of think of some of the, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne ideas about like, you know, sin being visible.
Well, although you said you don't know anything about that city, so maybe they really do have animals they're cursed with.
Okay, I'm pretty
sure. I feel
like
that would make the news.
I'm pretty sure that aspect is made up. But the rest of it is and one of the things I think that makes it a strong book is that it's obviously really grounded in, I think, I don't know that she's a journalist, but the way she writes, I think she probably has a background in journalism. But then sort of taking this set of like, we really like out there fantasy idea it doesn't have like a scientific explanation, at least so far within the book, but it has sort of all of these people. Like, this is what all these different people think it is. So, like, religious people think it's one thing. Scientists think it's this.
Yeah.
And you have these. So, but basically sort of just taking this idea and sort of seeing what you can do with the idea. And so that's kind of what I was talking about, having one really simple, basic idea as a jumping off point. There's another – I read a short story by a writer named Naomi Kritzer recently. And I don't just mean this to be a list of what I'm reading, but I'm just kind of using these because these are scientific or sort of specific examples, which is basically about a these people who don't want to live by the this kind of like sort of takeoff of the libertarian movement that doesn't want to live under, you know, that thinks the American government is oppressing them. So they basically go and live in these abandoned ships out in the ocean. And so it's basically sort of this almost like this sort of political fantasy, mm-hmm. as of the idea of like, okay, so what if you really did have this world where there were no laws? Right. You know, how would that work and how does it actually manifest? Those seem to me, they're not, I don't really think of that the writers are necessarily making a metaphor, like it's specifically, I guess that second one, it's not necessarily a metaphor. It's just sort of a speculation.
Yeah, it's an examination. I mean, but it is similar to like Kelly's talking about vampires being immortal. Like it forces you to examine humanity. We're using our imagination when we do that to create a new set of rules that allow us to shed some sort of light on of the human condition, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. if you really were all out, if you decided to secede from the United States and live out in international waters, you know, what would life be like? But it's all based on that premise. I'm curious, though, because you started this off by saying something interesting. You said, uh-oh. It's about me trying to make the toys so that I can play with them.
Right.
Why do you think you have to make them so that you can play? So there's still that question in my mind, which is why, which is, what drives you to twist the toys into what is it about vampires or science fiction robots or whatever that makes it more exciting to you as opposed to just telling something that's about, you know, 20 or 30 somethings in Virginia and, you know, in a band or whatever it is, you know, like something that's closer to reality.
I do feel like, go ahead.
Why would you play with Barbie when you can play with He-Man and Transformers and G.I. Joe and I just feel like it's more interesting on some basic level. If you're going to play with toys, play with the interesting toys.
And that's what I'm getting at. I'm like so curious, like why are those the more interesting toys? I think they are. I agree. And I think like for me, again, for Wormwood, just to put my own face on it, is that I didn't start off going like, what's the metaphor for my occult detective? No, I just said, I want to have a detective and he studies supernatural stuff and he's got this hand, it's in a glove and it's withered and gross and there's a reason for mm-hmm. that. I didn't think about the details of it. It's just that's what excites my imagination. But now I'm asking it of myself too. It's like, why am I drawn to that? And I think for me, if I were to, and this is more almost like analyzing myself, I think there's something underlying where I have certain thoughts about the way the world works and everything, and I think somehow, sometimes supernatural stuff or sort of an urban fantasy like Caroline is talking about, injecting something that's unexplainable into the world that doesn't map to what I know of the world is fascinating because it shakes something loose for me and it makes things less predictable and stranger. And I think I'm still talking about people and characters and my view of humanity and I'm still doing that meditation, but I'm just using different tools that kind of excite me more. But I think there's some underlying thing about why, like, say, magic appeals to me or why science fiction. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by that. And I don't know the answer. I'm just curious.
I think we've all heard the explanation of Buffy the Vampire Slayer's world building that, to teenagers, everything seems like the end of the world when you're in high school, uh-huh. so let's literally right. have it be that. And then on the other hand, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. that was just one guy who drew a sketch to crack up another guy, and then they thought, who is that turtle? Where does that turtle come from? What is that turtle right. story? And they built a world around that turtle. And then they built a $1 billion empire out of that turtle.
I think that's a great point because in Mouse Guard, in David Peterson talking about it in the Archaea panel, he's like, but he had kind of a reason. He's like, I thought about mice who are so small that everything seems huge to them. So what must they have to do to defend themselves? And so he's got these mouse guard, which are these guardian mice with swords that, you know, help mice get from one city to the next and things like that. And I thought that's very fascinating. He actually, I don't know, maybe he was looking at mice one day or whatever it was, but somehow he made the animal and their stature, you know, it kind of pushed him into this world. Like, okay, now let's do this with it. So, you know, I think you're right, Jim. I think that both of those things are accurate. One, it's just like this thing that excites you. It's something that sparks the imagination, and then you start building the world from that. In other cases, there may be some thing you're trying to get at, some emotional thing, and then it's easier to create. And that, I think, is much more clear when I look at like those surrealist paintings, because they have one moment, they have one thing, one image. So it's got to be boiled down to, this is what I'm feeling, or this is what I want you to see about this world. And so the meaning is much clearer, where sometimes in stories, and also I think, you know, there are cases where people just get so in love with the toys in the sandbox that they're not thinking, you know, about it in that level. They're just sort of, you know, playing with the toys. But, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's fascinating to me in stories and in art how we do this.
One thing that I think that you get out of the science fiction fantasy type of world building is you can have enormous stakes for everything. And I think that that's sort of what Jim was getting at with everything feels like the end of the world. Like, yes, you literally like you don't have to justify, why do we care about this conflict? Well, we care about this conflict because if you don't solve it, then, you know, your world is going to be destroyed. You know, there's not any,
absolutely. Yeah.
You know, your boyfriend will eat you if you don't solve this problem.
I think we talked about that when we started talking about fantasy early on in our genre shows. You know, that in my mind, fantasy was something that boiled down the human condition to like good versus evil, you know, or whatever. You look at, like, you know, Tolkien or whatever, and it yeah, you're right. It's we can show the conflict, and we can show friendship, and we can show evil very clearly by kind of taking it out of reality and putting it in this new landscape where it is, or Star Wars, for example, you know, very clearly it wears its heart on its sleeve, you know, but it uses this sort of metaphorical world to, you know, boil down humanity and show you good and bad, and, you know, where your heart can be and your friends can help you and all this kind of stuff. Very clearly that hero's journey, you know.
I think that's why, even in the real world, in non-fantasy settings, I think that's why we have so many TV shows that are about high school, so many TV shows that are about hospitals or about, the legal system. It's those are real world scenarios where there's a heightened sense of pretty much every emotion. I mean, it's literally life or death in hospitals and police procedurals. It feels like life or death in high school. It's that melodrama that comes with those settings that makes everything more interesting. And if you're a bored housewife, that's how you feel an escape. You know, if you're just watching a show where everyone's sitting around being bored housewives, that's boring. That's why we do the ones, you know, that are in New Jersey or in California. Even the bored housewife shows are made entirely of melodrama, or it's, you know, right. Parenthood is toddlers and tiaras. It's not, I don't think it's interesting to any of us if it's boring.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny when you said that about height.
It's interesting.
When you said that about heightening the emotional stakes, it makes me think of there's a show sadly canceled on TV right now called Awake. And the premise, you know, if you guys don't know it, is this cop wakes up in one reality where he had this accident, and he wakes up in one reality where his son was killed in a car accident. He wakes up in another reality when he goes to sleep at night. He wakes up again. Now he's in a reality where his wife died in that same car accident. And
oh my gosh, every time he wakes up, he's in a new alternate reality?
Yeah.
No, it's just two different ones.
The two. It goes back and forth. And so
that would be so much cooler.
He's seeing a shrink in each one, and each one is like, you know, you're dealing with this dream world. And he's like, that's what the other shrink always says. You know, and it's sort of playing this fun game of like, you don't know which one's real or which one's not. But when you talk about the emotional stakes, my thought after watching about three episodes is, oh my God, this show is always sad. It's always emotionally devastating because in both realities, he's grieving a different family member.
Yep.
Yeah. And he doesn't want either one of them to be true, basically.
Yeah. And it's so fascinating to me. And I actually think it's a really good show. It's very cleverly done. I'm sad to see it go. But it was one where I realized, I'm like, I don't know if I could take this show, you know, like watching all of them in a row, because it's really sad because he's mourning his wife, and now he's mourning his son. Now he's mourning his wife again. Now his son, his wife knows that his son is dead, but knows that he believes that his son is alive in his dreams, and she wants to talk to the son, but can't. And he's the only person. But it's just crazy.
They. I'm not happy to see anything get canceled, except maybe Jersey Shore. But that they couldn't have done that for 4 years.
No. And that was something Paul and I talked about that on a podcast, and Paul Montgomery, and we said the same thing. Like, I have no idea how they'll make this last, but right now it's really working for me.
Right.
You know, but it was, again, it was building a world where there's actually two worlds. And the idea was that it just creates this heightened emotional stakes, you know, between this. And he's actually in both of them. So that's kind of a unique instance of building two worlds as one. And that's all I have to say about that.
There was silence. So I think to wrap up, because it's about that time, I think every time we've talked about even different reasons why people build a world, whether it's a metaphor, whether it's to play with toys, whether it's to explore the human condition, whether it's to add a heightened sense of melodrama, every time we've talked about it, somebody has started with, there's one question that somebody wants to explore. There's one moment that makes you think, what does this look like? Whether it's what actually would happen if a bunch of people got onto a boat and created their own country. What happens if every criminal, you know, has some sort of physical projection of the fact that they're a criminal? What happens if you can live forever? What happens if you have unlimited power in some fashion? I think there's always just something interesting that you want to explore. And I kind of feel like that's the germ that starts almost all writing.
No, I agree.
You reach a point where you want to explore some question. And I think that's why you build a world. That's the first step in exploring that question. And whether the world is the question, whether the world that you build is, what is it like if we all have magic these days? You know, what is it like if every creepy supernatural thing is real? Sometimes you start building the world with that question, but there's always a single question.
Yeah, I think you summed that up very well. Yeah, I think that's perfect. I think, you know, as much as we're saying this, we're examining it, we're asking that question, why? Because I think it is important for all writers to ask that at some point, just to make sure that, you know, you're in command of what you're doing. There is, you can also look at it too deeply, and sometimes you got to step back and say, you know what? Making things a little weird, making things a little strange, it's exciting. It excites the imagination. And whether we're writing something set in the real world or something set in the farthest flung world we can imagine, you know, we're all writing because there's something that excites us, that sparks our imagination. And so there's no sense in not letting it be this whole new world if it gets us somewhere exciting and interesting and allows us. And hopefully, if we're excited and interesting in what we're telling, in this world we're telling, we're exploring something within ourselves. And, you know, we're not just moving toys around in a sandbox, but we're actually kind of examining something. And I think that's where that sort of excitement matches and hits that emotional core too. And I think that's really, really amazing. And I think, you know, why not? We have the imagination, you know, we have the ability to not just say, hey, let's drive a car. We can say, hey, let's fly a giant talking eagle. And so we should take advantage of that and explore what that does, where you go with that.
We should all write a talking eagle story for next time.
I have no idea where that came from. Probably
Lord of the Rings. Well, I think that's where we started, right?
Yeah. No, yes. I know. I mean, initially, I think it's Lord of the Rings. But, you know, I don't know why that popped into my head.
The more I think about Kelly's process, the more I desperately want us to do a round robin where Kelly writes one chapter and then I write the next one and then she writes the next one and on and on.
Why do you hate me?
Also known as Kelly's last story.
The day everyone drove Kelly insane.
She's still writing that
round robin. I would just find
a
way. See, the thing is, I'm really good at figuring out why. So I don't, and this, I'm going to paint myself into a corner that I can't get out of, which is a great example of world building. Bring it. I don't think you could make the story cohesive in your chapter to the point where I couldn't work my way out of it in my chapter.
Whoa. Challenge accepted.
First of all.
I said cohesive. Like, no fair going like, and then a giant talking bird falls out of the sky. Figure that one out, Cal.
First of all, pistols at dawn. Second of all, I'm not trying to paint you into a corner. If anything, I would be using my chapters to demonstrate that planning nothing and planning everything brings you to just about the exact same point.
I sense a challenge.
Oh my God, they all hung up. Is this how you get kicked out of the deception?
I think you plan more
I think we all plan more than we think we do. I don't think everyone gets out spreadsheets and goes to town on data and linguistic challenges and draws out the entire world. But I think every good writer knows a lot more about their world than what goes down on that paper. And I think it's the good writer piece of it that's key. Bad writers can do all sorts of things, but I don't want to be a bad writer.
This could turn into a rant about my wife's obsessive compulsive disorder in less than two moves. Forever planning, never implementing the plan.
Well, I think one of the things we may do, and we'll figure this out, you know, I'd love to see this challenge that Jim is throwing out. But, I mean, we probably will at some point in this series do some sort of writing challenge, and we'd invite our listeners to join us in it. But maybe, you know, do some kind of experiment of writing and building a world and stuff like that. But we have a bunch of shows, I think, in store where we talk about that. As you can see from this show alone, right, guys, so we have a lot to talk about. And so we have sort of a loose structure in mind, giving ourselves some room to change things as we go. But I think
we have planned.
Yeah, we have planned.
Right.
We have a roadmap. Outline. Yeah, we have an outline, and we are going to try and stick as best as we can to our monthly schedule. But hopefully, you folks will see that our little break there re-energized us, and we actually did all get together, and that was a lot of fun. Now I know, you know,
we
what it's
so
like to
pictures.
Sit with everyone and talk.
Boy, I could go for some Thai food right now.
Did we ever answer that person on Facebook who was like, "Are you guys ever going to put out another podcast so I don't have to delete you?"
I did. I don't know if they saw. I did. Answer that. There was a Facebook message saying, "I'm going through deleting all my inactive feeds."
We love you, Facebook reader. I don't know.
Why would you delete an inactive feed? It's not bothering you. It's sitting there being empty.
I know. Sometimes,
maybe you have a limit on how many you can have.
Sometimes I'm looking to streamline, and I go to delete the ones that haven't updated in a while, and I'm like, those are the ones I should keep.
Right.
Because they're not keeping me busy.
Asshole. No, we are back.
But the point is that I appreciate it. I think it was Jody. I appreciate that
yes.
that person was concerned.
It was
yes,
Jody.
I'm the jerk of the group. And I also appreciate it. Like our things and want to hear more.
Well, no, we're hopefully going to stick to our monthly schedule from here on out until the next convention comes around. But no, seriously, I think that you guys are going to enjoy what we have in store, and we're definitely going to try to keep going on a monthly basis. So let's talk about where people can find us. Caroline, where's our website?
We are at – no, I'm sorry, we're not at because that's Twitter. thedeceptionist.org.
That's right. And we are on Twitter, Kelly.
At Deceptionist, no the.
Because the would be too long. And do we have an email address that people can send us letters to, Jim?
Yeah.
And that would be?
Jimsky@jimsky.net is where that usually goes.
Or I believe we have contact@thedeceptionist.org, right?
Oh, the thing you said.
Yeah. That one. We also have a Facebook page, as we mentioned, where you can ask us if we're going to do another show. But like us on Facebook either way, and we promise we'll keep doing shows. And when you bug us, you keep us honest. So that's good. Leave us reviews on iTunes because we really like that. It feeds our ego. Sorry, side note about my ego. I actually was recognized on the street today as someone who likes by somebody who likes the podcast, The Fuzzy Typewriter and Wormwood. I was like, whoa, wow, you know who I am? That's cool. I don't know. I like that.
That is pretty amazing.
And we
Jim
should...
was recognized yes. on the train to Chicago by the sound of his voice.
I love that story.
I was not emotionally prepared for that.
It's kind of shocking, isn't it?
Yes, very much so.
So do we want to plug anything that we're doing right now before we head off?
I don't know. Dave, you doing anything interesting over there?
You might say that. Oh, so I'm going to desperately try to get this show out quickly because I have a comic book coming out, as listeners probably know, from Hermes Press. It comes out in July. It's called Sparrow and Crow, The Demoniac of Los Angeles. It's based on my characters from the aforementioned Wormwood audio show, but you don't need to know any of that to enjoy this. It's just a sort of horror noir book that's a 5-issue miniseries. The first issue is actually in the pre-order catalog now, so if you go to your regular comic book shop, ask them this week to please order Sparrow and Crow #1 in July. You know, because they have to put those orders in early. That's just the way the comic system works. And if you're there, if it's a small independent book, there's no guarantee that retailers will order it and stock it on the shelves because they know they can sell Spider-Man, but they don't know who we are. So, you know, you can find out more information at Sparrow and Crowe, that's CROWE.com. Or you can find me on Twitter at DACCAMPO and I can tell you all about it. But yeah, check that out. And, anybody else? Caroline, you were working on some writing this past weekend, I think.
Oh, I was going to do that. I don't know how much. I took some notes. I had a story idea, and then I took some notes, and it may be a different story idea. I also have an essay in the, I guess I should plug it in the, although this is not fiction writing, in the book Chicksting Comics, which is out from Mad Norwegian Press. So you can still find that on the internet, ebooks, various bookstores. And that was co-edited by Sigrid Ellis, who has been a guest host on the show, and Lynn Thomas is the other editor.
And that's a great book. I got my copy at C2E2, and yeah, we got a bona fide author on our show. Jim, how about you?
Well, on Twitter, I am Jimski, J-A-M-S-K-I. I also once a week write a column at ifanboy.com on Mondays. It is technically not fiction writing, although many of the commenters seem to think my take on reality might as well be fiction.
He's building his own world again.
I was going to say, you build your own world every Monday.
And Kelly.
So 16 years ago, this video game came out called Diablo.
Uh-oh.
And 16 days ago, no, less than 16 days ago, they put out the third one, finally, after like a 11-year drought. So I'm doing that.
You know, it's a world. It's about building worlds.
It actually, you know, I don't want to be like, of course, it's totally relevant to what we're talking about, but they're doing a lot in the third installment of the series that is walking a really fine line between sort of regurgitating the mythology and the plot of the first couple and building on it and putting in like little Easter eggs. And it's I've actually been almost distracted by the story. Like, I want to get back to clicking and beating things up and getting pretty things. But like, the story that they're building is, it's interesting how they're walking that line.
You know, I would not be surprised if video games come up again in our world building discussion. I mean, that's become a real part of fantasy worlds and building worlds, you know, so and storytelling. So
yeah, well, they're turning movies into video games and video games into movies as fast as they can.
Exactly. Yeah. So I suspect that one will come up in our future shows. Okay, so I think that wraps up the first of our world building series, and we will be back again next month. So we will now try to sign off, and I'm going to say my name. Then it's going to go Caroline, Jim, Kelly. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Look at that. I planned, and it worked out.
And it took us forever to get through, but all right. Bye, guys.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.